Hey everyone, it's David Chen here with a special Patreon After Dark about David Lynch's 1984 version of Dune, featuring guest Max Ivry. If you are a fan of the Filmcast and you want to support what we do, help keep the podcast going for long into the future, the best way to do that is becoming a patron at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We talk about old movies. We talk about your questions and emails. We talk about funny stories and things that have happened to us recently, all on the After Dark at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Every now and then, we put one of the After Darks on the main feed, and so here is one for you to enjoy. Thanks to all of our patrons who make this podcast possible. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast After Dark, the after show for the Filmcast, where we talk about a variety of random topics that didn't make it into the show. I'm David Chen, joined by Devendra Hardware and Jeff Kanata. This episode brought to you courtesy of the fine folks at patreon.com/filmpodcast.
Thank you
so much for your support at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We really appreciate it. We got a special treat for you today. We have been doing our Dune series. We recently discussed Dune Part 1 on last week's After Dark, revisited it. We covered Dune Part 2 in the main episode. Well, why not cap the whole thing off by discussing the Dune that started it all, the 1984 David Lynch version of Dune. We have the perfect guest for this episode joining us today. He is the author of A Masterpiece in Disarray, an extensive 560-page book on the making, unmaking, and reclaiming of David Lynch's Dune. He's also going to be screening this movie with Matt Zoller Seitz at the Texas Theater in Dallas, Texas on March 9th. Max Ivry, welcome back to the Filmcast.
How's everybody doing tonight?
How are you doing?
Max, before we, you know, this is my first time watching the David Lynch Dune. Devendra and Jeff have seen it before, but not for a while. So it's all fresh in our minds. Mm-hmm. Before we kind of talk about this, I want to hear from you. Why did you dedicate such a massive portion of your life to studying this movie?
Max must be sick of this movie by this point. This has been your life, man.
Well, this month in particular, with all the March Madness with Dune Part 2, there's definitely been an uptick in interest about the book, because the book was supposed to come out. The book came out in September when it was supposed to.
When Dune 2 was supposed to come out. Dune Part 2 was supposed to come out in October or November.
I was supposed to be riding those wormtails, and I was not. So now we're in our second wind. It's almost impossible for me to get sick of talking about this book, because honestly, like every podcast I do, I love talking to people about it, and you know, getting that level of insight. You know, like I know Devendra has read my book or some of it, I love you guys. I've been popping up on this show every couple of years for a while, so I'm happy to poke my head up again.
Well, we're happy to have you. But what is it about David Lynch's Dune that entrances you so?
Well, the thing I always tell people is it's a little like the I don't know if you've ever seen the Night Gallery episode with the earwig, where it crawls into the guy's ear, it lays some eggs, and then it crawls out. And eventually, for me, the earwig was Dune, and the eggs eventually hatched, and I was like, oh, I'm into this movie now. It wasn't like a Star Wars thing where it was a perennial thing from my childhood that I broke the VHS tape from watching it so much. I didn't see it until I was 11 or 12, and it didn't blow my skirt up or anything. Mm-hmm. I think I saw the Alan Smithy cut, the TV version first.
That is a version of the television cut, which David Lynch disowned and therefore put Alan Smithy as the director name on that, right?
Yes, it's fucking awful. I know, because I recently not only rewatched it, but I did a 3-hour commentary on it for a Blu-ray release from ViaVision. So that's coming out in April. And
you're truly living the dream and the nightmare, Max.
It's one of those commentaries. I don't know if you hear this very often, but it's a commentary where I spend most of the time trying to convince the viewer that what they're watching is awful.
Love it. It's like a Ben Affleck's Armageddon commentary.
Yeah,
you know, one of the classics. Right. Yeah,
you
yeah.
just point the drill and turn it on.
All right, so we're gonna start talking about David Lynch's Dune. And we will spoil David Lynch's Dune. And that means that we will be spoiling Dune Part 2 because they encompass the same plot material. There will be... Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Max?
They absolutely encompass the same material, but like the thing that I'm so happy about having seen, you know, Doom Part 2 now is they're just totally different movies.
Absolutely. Yeah.
They just
couldn't be further apart. So we will
I don't
be spoiling.
I would say couldn't be further apart. I think there's some really interesting ways that the same material is done the same way in certain instances, but we'll get to that.
Fair point. I was using hyperbole to try to make a point, and I got called out. I got called out on it. And,
I was correcting you.
Now it's now this segment is ruined.
How dare you?
My job here is done.
Anyway, so we will be spoiling the plot of David Lynch's Dune, and therefore Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. There will be no spoilers for future books, possibly until the very end of the episode, and we will make it very clear when that happens. So I just want people to know what we're spoiling starting now.
Yes.
So David Lynch's Dune. This is my first time watching. Devendra and Jeff, you guys have seen it before. I mean, Devendra, let's start with you.
Yeah.
Kind of, what was your reaction watching David Lynch's 1984 Dune this time around?
Well, this time around, I think I appreciated it a lot more because, first of all, I got the Arrow 4K release that recently came out. So I've never seen this movie look this good. The first time I saw it was probably in college from like a bad downloaded rip along with some friends on a tiny TV. So it's not the best way to see this movie because then you're just focusing on how so many things are wrong, how it doesn't, the acting is stilted and the writing is overcooked and they're just trying to push all the plot in here. But rewatching this movie now on like a big screen on my home theater projector, this is a stunning movie. I think like so many of the tableaus, the set design, the wardrobe, like everything, I think it looks beautiful. And it starts off really strong to me, even though it's a very different film from the Villeneuve one, at least narratively wise. And then it falls apart completely by the end. Like after a certain point, they're like, oh crap, we're running out of budget. We got to get through this book. We have all this plot. It does feel like they just like push the rest of the movie through. Basically like once Paul meets the Fremen, it's just all kind of barreling forward from there.
That's right.
I think the first half of this movie is not that far from the Villeneuve
one, somewhat,
to be honest.
I would describe it as somewhat competent, the first half of the movie, right?
I mean, it is a very acquired taste, I will say. You can't just put this movie in front of somebody and expect them to love it, but I think it's something you can learn to appreciate over time, and I certainly have, yeah.
There's arguably stuff in this movie that helped me to understand Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 1 better.
What's up with the navigators,
The navigators and how that works. And
how do they move through space? It's a whole
thing. They lay out the different planets and so on. Max, go ahead.
Yeah, the folding of the space is completely ignored. I would say Denis Villeneuve does not do a very good job of explaining either visually or expositorially like why the spice is important.
Right, yeah.
you hear a clip from one of the like encyclopedias he's listening to. Like you hear a clip of that, but that's pretty much it. I think the folding scene in the Villeneuve movie was fascinating the first time I saw it because it's just like it just happened
in the Lynch movie. Like, you mean, or
in the Villeneuve Dune, like you see the ships just kind of appear.
They go into the little rectum thing in space,
and then they appear in front of Arrakis.
That's right.
Yeah. The fact that it just kind of happened and they didn't say anything, to me was wild too.
I think that was partially inspired by that Lawrence of Arabia cut where he blows out the match and then you cut in the desert. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like. That I think they were trying to do a similar thing there, but it's and also the folding of space was something David really, really, really wanted to put in the film. He didn't have to put it in, but it was really important to him. If you read my book, you know, like they did it really cheaply and it kind of shows, but it's like, and it's not really that close to what he originally intended. Mm-hmm. But it's still like this fascinating, like almost transcendental scene in the film.
For a man who has dedicated his life to transcendental meditation, I'm not surprised. Like this is so fast. Like you make this movie just to do that scene because you don't see that in movies too often, you know?
No.
Jeff Cannata, I'm so curious. Like, what was your reaction? We just watched Dune Part 2 in theaters, one of the most spectacular theatrical experiences of the last few years.
Yeah.
And then going from that to watch Dune Part, David Lynch Dune, what was your reaction?
Well, certainly it does not compare favorably. I'm a bit jealous of Devendra watching the 4K of this because I think the Max, the one to watch for HBO version, is pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Not a good cut. Yeah.
It is really, I think the sound edit, the sound is not even in, it's not even in surround sound. You know, it's like, it's, I was pretty disappointed with the mm-hmm. streaming version, mm-hmm. Just on a quality level. But I guarantee you, still the best quality level I've ever seen this movie at.
Yes.
Because I am 100% certain the first time I watched it, it was on VHS and on some 13-inch tube television somewhere. And as a young person visiting this movie, I just did not understand why this was entertainment. You know,
well, that's me trying to read the Dune books too. It's like, this is hard.
Well, I read the book later after I'd sort of gotten old enough to recognize what it was about. But as a kid, it was like, I like science fiction and I want to watch Star Wars movies. And so here's a cool site. And it was just like, what, mm-hmm. what, what's this guy with boils on his face? Mm-hmm. Why are they lancing the boils in this movie? What's that?
So you were reacting exactly as the studio execs did in 1984.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sure they also had the brain of an 8-year-old boy.
As Gremlins 2 proved. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
I, revisiting it now, it's hard, right? As I did not watch it until after we had seen both of Villeneuve's movies. Mm-hmm. So again, it does not compare favorably. There's a certain charm to its 80s-ness and a certain charm to its reach and its ambition. The sets feel like sets. The production design feels like they cobbled together stuff from the secondhand store. You know, there's a certain kind of lovely handmade charm to it. The creature effects are, I mean, the idea that this movie came out 2 years after Empire Strikes Back and you watch Empire Strikes Back and how contemporary it still feels and how like the creature effects still look pretty good. And I buy the Tauntaun and I buy, you know, like, yes, it's dated. Some of that stuff's dated, but not in the way this movie is. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, right? I think it speaks to the filmmaking and the filmmaker and maybe the overreach a bit but again, I'm charmed by its ambition and I'm charmed by the fact that the intention was to like put this thing literally warts and all on the screen. Mm-hmm. And, that does not mean I think it is more successful than I did at 8. I kind of don't. I kind of think it is still a kind of spectacular failure, but I more appreciate the attempt and more appreciate the ambition in the attempt. You know, I do think that it's swinging, right? It's swinging for something. I just don't think the movie fundamentally kind of works on a base level. Like it doesn't, it's not, its pacing is kind of weird and all over the place. It doesn't have exciting moments, really. It's got captivating characters and really interesting art direction. But ultimately, like from a pure plot level and a A to B to C level, it doesn't really bring me through its story in a way that I find successful. And I think it's a really interesting historical record, but I don't think it's a movie that I would ever suggest people watch to enjoy.
It does have Space Navigator in a Jar.
Yeah.
The Villeneuve's movie does not.
So I'll bring up a few things about the movie. Then I want to hear from Max about kind of some of the stuff you found while studying the movie. Right. Mm-hmm. But I agree with everything you guys have said. I think the movie's a mess. Right. It's particularly the last hour. It is wild to consider that they put two movies worth of plot into one movie that is less than the runtime of one of the two movies, right?
Yeah. Like, well, I don't think anybody then would think it's two movies worth of plot.
Sure, sure. But I'm saying now that we've seen it spread out into two movies worth of plot, we're like, Okay, that's those.
We knew that was a long book. You look at that book, you're like, that's a lot.
That's 5 hours of movie, Jeff, that barely contains that plot, right? That's 5 hours of movie that barely, Dune Part 1 and Part 2, right?
Yeah, but you got to remember what the world was like.
Yeah, I'm getting to it.
Originally, someone went to Peter Jackson. It was like, can you do The Lord of the Rings in a movie?
Yeah.
And he was like, it kind of needs to be 3 movies. I think that's the way it used to be.
I think originally they planned on 2 movies, if I recall correctly.
Then
he's like, F it, fuck it. We're doing 1 movie per book.
Yeah.
So it's wild to think that we've seen it in 2 movies and now they've compressed it into less than the length of one of the movies. Either one of the movies. And that is, it shows. But I will say there's a bunch of things that impress me about David Lynch Dune. First of all, as we've discussed, some of the creature effects are charming, are good. There seems like there's been a lot of miniatures used. And I think miniatures in general age very well because somebody went out, built a thing, filmed a thing, did a thing to it, you know, like, and that just doesn't, there's a tactility to it that doesn't go away no matter how many years have passed. And the other thing is the score. I think it kind of rips.
I love it.
You know?
The guitar riff when you get on the sandworm, dude. Come on.
You know, like, it's just like kind of a good.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of a good score.
Do you like it better than the Hans Zimmer score, by the way, Dave? Because you do not like the Hans Zimmer score.
I loved the Hans Zimmer score for Part 2.
Okay.
Didn't like it for Part 1 that much.
Music always sounds like he fell asleep on his keyboard.
Which one? Hans Zimmer?
Hans Zimmer, yeah. I absolutely despised his Blade Runner score, especially because I heard some pieces from the original score that the other guy did, the guy who killed himself. I really loved his score, and I'm like, why did you just replace it with this Hans Zimmer mush?
Yeah, I remember that. Blade Runner 2049 didn't really have much. Yeah.
No. Yeah. But what were you saying, Dave, about the score?
Yeah, I was trying to figure out who you're referring to, who originally worked on the score. Is it
Johan Johansson? Was that his name?
Yeah, but I didn't know that he took his own life. Anyway, I got to look into that, and
there's
I will do that.
There's a whole lot going on there.
At some point during this episode. But the other thing I was going to say is... something Vincenzo Natali said really stuck out to me, and it kind of goes to this point you were making, Jeff, which is that Dune Part 2, the Denis Villeneuve version, could only come out now because, like, we live in a time that can accept that level of sci-fi sophistication.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That, like, back then, it's like, oh, we got to have a woman narrate the basic plot. And then we got to tell you what the Emperor's plan is.
Explain it like I'm 5.
Yeah.
It's crazy to me that the decision that Lynch makes is we're just going to hear people's thoughts. Yeah. We're just like through the whole movie, all kinds of different characters. We're just going to hear their thoughts because I can't figure out a better way to do this.
Max, you have the background on this, actually. Like, how much of that sort of thing was Lynch, and how much of it was the studio being like, you got to explain this damn movie?
Yeah. So the inner thoughts, you know, that comes from Herbert's book. I just did a piece for Wired where I reviewed Frank Herbert's own screenplay for Dune, which he wrote in the 70s prior to Ridley Scott or David Lynch, and it's awful. But it also included those voiceovers, and it also included it the way Villeneuve did it, where you have people kind of psychically speaking to each other. There was that in Frank's script as well. It's a piece of shit. But in terms of what Lynch was doing, about it was originally about 40% of what is there now, and then they added so much more just to kind of fill in the gaps. And he hated that because it was like it wasn't meant to be Edgar the Explainer type thing or whatever. It was supposed to, you know, just kind of, you know, put you into the heads of these characters and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, it was a really cool idea that unfortunately was overused and overexploited. But I mean, I've heard, you know, filmmakers like Adam McKay be like, why hasn't that been more of a thing? Like, you know, hearing characters.
Well, it's interesting because anybody that reads a book, any book, mm-hmm. not just Dune, any book, you are inside the head of the characters, right? Mm-hmm. That's like one of the joys of books, is that you get the inner thoughts of a character. And that has to be one of the most difficult things of adapting any book, any novel, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, wow, as a writer, you're allowed to just express the thoughts of a character. And as a screenwriter, it's much more difficult. You got to do it in action and dialogue.
Yeah, you have to externalize the internal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Unless you don't. You And I think that's pretty wild that are just like, you know what, let's just let us hear their thoughts.
literally all of them, it doesn't matter if they have psychic powers or not.
Yeah, we're right. Just gonna, doesn't matter if they're a main character, a side character. Yep. Just let them do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the opening of the movie is very expository. It's mm-hmm. hey, we have this person explaining. First they have is it Virginia Madsen explaining? Mm-hmm.
Princess Irulan.
Yeah, here's the plot of the movie. Then there's a separate bookending part where it's like it looks like a film book or whatever, where it's like there's four planets that we're concerned with, and then they're naming the planets, and here they are. Yeah. And don't worry, you're not going to be confused, right? And
yeah,
that's Kyle's voice, by the way.
Yeah. And it just we don't need any of that. And also, here's a question: is The decision in the Denis Villeneuve movies to tell the story from the Atreides POV, compared to how we see it played out in this movie, brilliant. It's just like, wow, what a great decision.
Seems like a no-brainer in retrospect. But
it seems like a no-brainer, but you know, Max, I'm guessing not necessarily a totally obvious choice, right? What do you think?
In terms of having the POV be solely from the Atreides?
It was solely Atreides, so we're kind of following their journey, and then, oop, betrayal, and then terrible things happen, right? That's not the way the David Lynch Dune movie is structured. It's structured as, we're going to tell, it's structured like a grade school paper. Tell them what they're going to tell you.
Yeah. Let's start with the Emperor and this weird monster telling him to do stuff.
Tell them what you're going to tell him, then tell him what you told him. That's kind of how I learned to write thesis papers. Right?
I think it's like, I think that it should have been something in between, because it's like, to a certain extent, I think Villeneuve underexplains things like mm-hmm. we talked about mm-hmm. how like you don't understand the spice, you don't understand folding space, you don't mm-hmm. understand, and then you like there, you get scenes like in part one, you know, of Duke Leto, you know, talking about, you know, Paul's grandfather and the bull, and you're like, what is all that? You know, so it's like if you hadn't read the book, mm-hmm. you don't know what that's about. You really don't, and but, you know, so I mean, like maybe you could intuit it, but it's like it's like there's a little bit more mm-hmm. there should be a little bit more nuance to it, I think, especially in part one. I think in part two he was able to cut loose a little more and not be so mired in establishing all these characters and all the background and everything. He's able to just mm-hmm. kind of, you know, hit the ground and run with it. So
By the way, clarification from earlier. So Johan Johansson did mm-hmm. write some of the score for Blade Runner 2049. Then Denis Villeneuve decided to change direction of the score.
Yeah.
And then he shortly after died of a cocaine overdose. So just want to clarify what that was about.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to praise about the Dune, the David Lynch Dune, is like the creature effects, you know, like the look, all the Harkonnen stuff. I'm gonna say it doesn't look as good, but it's similarly gross.
It's cool. It's good. It's evocative. It's completely. You cannot ignore it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean. Yeah. The other thing I forgot to mention is when I was a kid, I have a vivid memory of thinking the shields in the Lynch Dune were mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Were like incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I remember just thinking that was the coolest effect I had ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And watching it the other day, I was like, oh my God. It's crazy.
It's barely comprehensible, I would
say. It's barely comprehensible.
Yeah.
It's really wild.
You can't even understand kind of what is going
on. But dude, in 80, whatever it was that I watched this movie in.
This is the future.
Man. Incredible.
I mean, incredible. I will say in defense of the shields, I mean, I personally think that's one of the coolest effects in the film, but that's partly because I know there was absolutely zero CGI involved. It was all opticals and hand done stuff.
Nice.
And it actually, Barry Nolan, the guy who was the effects supervisor, told me that, you know, the guys who wound up doing the Predator effects for John McTiernan's first Predator movie, they consulted with Barry Nolan to ask them how they did the shields, and that they they used a lot of that. But I think it's a cool effect. It is one of the only effects in the film that is actually what David wanted. Hmm. Like that is specifically what he had storyboarded, is that, you know, kind of jagged, blocky, kind of amorphous,
polygonal.
It's it looks
just
CGI,
want everybody to look like Gumby, okay, like sharp Gumbies. Let's fight. Like
I can tell
Gumbies.
It was. I could certainly tell it was effortful. I think like it looked like it was a lot of work. This kind of was my reaction to it.
Yeah, but, and if it reminded you a little bit of a lightsaber too, that's because Barry Nolan also did the lightsabers for Star Wars.
Max, when you think of some of the more remarkable sort of anecdotes, when you think back, you know, you obviously know a lot about this movie, but what are some of the key things that stick out that you're like, oh, I can't believe that's true? You know, like what are some of the things that like blow your mind about the David Lynch dude?
Well, one of the biggest things that I wanted to get to the bottom of when I wrote the book was the decision of John Dykstra and his Apogee effects to pull out of the film before it had even finished shooting, and after they'd only completed a handful of effect shots. Because I know like that was a catastrophic thing that happened to the production. Like they went with Apogee because, you know, they were like, after ILM, they were the best in the business. Mm-hmm. You know, like John Dykstra, you know, used to be part of ILM. He won an Oscar for Star Wars and, you know, he'd done Battlestar Galactica, Star Trek The Motion Picture. Like, he knew how to pull this stuff off. And, you know, it's like the problem, there were a lot of reasons why it didn't work out, you know, and all having to do with money. But, what Jeff is saying, like that, you know, saying like some of it is charming, but it's like it doesn't quite work. I mean, a lot of that is because they had to pull in kind of the B squad, you know, and rush through it, you know, and just get everything done on a budget. And they had to eliminate so many of David's original storyboards. I've seen those storyboards. What David had in mind was unbelievable. Like there are scenes with like, you know, 5,000 ships, you know, flying over like 2,000 worms, you know, it's like just really grandiose action sequences. And also compared to, you know, part two of Villeneuve's film, you know, like Villeneuve does it kind of like the way it is in the book, which is you get a little taste of the battle and then they just cut to the Great Hall, you know, and like, and that's how it is in the book, and that's how it is in Villeneuve's film. In Lynch's film, the battle is pretty extensive,
last like 20 minutes of the movie, right?
But it was supposed to be even bigger, like even wilder. And they couldn't do that. They had to just cut everything. And I think that's, that's part of what is the tragedy of the film. It's like, this was a special effects movie. So like, and unfortunately they blew a lot of their money in principal photography. So like they had to shortchange arguably, you know, one of, if not the most important parts of the film, you know, and I think that it definitely pissed David off, but it was kind of par for the course with, you know, the way Dino operated, Dino De Laurentiis, the way the studio was kind of becoming disenchanted with the film because they realized it wasn't going to be Star Wars. I think it was either David or Jeff or, you know, you pointed out that like some of the model shots look really good. And I'm betting most of those were probably the ones by Emilio Ruiz del Rio, because he did a lot of the foreground miniatures, which is basically where you have a giant miniature in front of the camera.
A lot of the miniatures look pretty great, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's a hole cut in the miniature, and you have actors way, way in the distance.
Right.
You know, in that hole. So there's no optical. It's just all in camera, and it's all there's no processing so involved, and that's why those shots look great. So, when talking about, you know, what's the thing that really, you know, shocked me was just how, you know, they could hobble themselves in that way and, you know, and not just, you know, stay the course with Dykstra. But as one of the effects guys told me, like, that, you know, David Lynch's Dune had a pretty big budget, but it needed kind of an unlimited budget.
This is a cursed project. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think for me, the thing that goes wrong is we just completely lose Paul's journey. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. That's the problem with this Dune movie is like all the cheesy effects and Sting and the weird ass underwear and all that stuff. Like, that's all fine and cool and quaint and charming and a little bit dated. But the thing that prevents this movie from being good, in my opinion, is just Paul's journey is completely nonsensical by the end. He's just going from thing to thing to thing. And it's like, I don't even know why he thinks this or what he's doing.
Let's have these thousands of troops listen to this teenager who just joined our ranks. Right. He's going to tell us how to do battle.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Whereas in Dune Part 2, the Denis Villeneuve, it's a much more plausible depiction of how that would play out. Like, it takes the time to show how Paul kind of integrates himself into this society and how his name becomes, you know, more revered over time and so on and so forth. So that's really the biggest failing of the movie for me. It's not the visuals or anything. It's that Paul's journey gets lost.
Mm-hmm. I think part of that is like, you know, it's some of that harkens back to the novel because, you know, Paul Atreides does kind of, you know, after the Harkonnens attack and Leto is dead, you know, and he has kind of a low point. From the moment he meets up with the Fremen, it's kind of just win, 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 win. Like, he's almost like a Mary Sue kind of character in that he just, you know, it's just one, you know, successful triumph after another, you know, but the difference between the Lynch one and the Villeneuve one is in the Lynch one, he's just a god. Like, he just is a messiah. Mm-hmm. And in the Villeneuve one, he's a false messiah. He's a false prophet. And
as he himself does not believe in the Denis Villeneuve one, he himself does not believe that he is the messiah. That's what you're saying.
Exactly.
To,
and so every win is a loss. Mm-hmm. Every win becomes that much more, you know, tension building because, you know, he knows he's getting closer and closer to this terrible purpose he has. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I thought that was a really brilliant aspect of Villeneuve's. I mean, like the main thing that separates the two films is, you know, that Villeneuve falls into line with Herbert's message of, you know, a warning against charismatic leaders and fanaticism, whereas Lynch's movie is
a celebration.
It's somebody said it's like a propaganda movie that the Bene Gesserit would have made.
It's the Bene Gesserit's Starship Troopers, basically.
Well, the ending is fairly ludicrous, right? Like he ascends the throne and then rain starts falling and
killing all the sandworms.
Yeah, cut to credits, which, by the way, some of the most ridiculous end credits I've ever seen in a movie. Like, just every single character in the end credits feels like they're in a different movie, and it looks like it's from, like, I'm gonna say, I don't know, like a Lifetime original, you know, like it's like one of those movies where, like, it, you know, it's like from an 80s movie. Yeah. Obviously,
it's like being
the
Predator.
Yeah.
Hey where, guys,
yeah, it's like, yay! It's like the showing a guy and like
beginning of a sitcom is what
right,
it is.
Right, like a sitcom, exactly. Yeah. It's the most bizarre kind of
I was thinking about credits, that because I rewatched Predator lately, and like that sort of ending is like, I do kind of miss it. It's like, hey, we're on a journey with these guys. They're all dead now, but
but let's step back through and remember the times
let's
we all
remember
shared.
The good times.
No, I like that ending of Predator. It works for that movie because the ending of Predator is actually really, like, kind of, you know, sullen and sad, like a bummer. But like then they have that credit sequence and it's like, this was all just fun. Like we just had fun doing this. It's like, you know, we put on a little show for y'all in the jungle. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Dune credits, I don't know. I didn't put that much thought into how weird they are, but I guess they are kind of weird.
Here's what I'm going to say. Massive upgrade from Dune Part 2 to David Lynch Dune is, and again, this is a spoiler for Dune Part 2, but we meet Paul's sister for like 10 seconds in Dune Part 2 in a, mm-hmm. like a dream sequence. Gonna say, creepy little girl threatening the Emperor, that's like way better.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Than whatever happened.
Yeah, killing...
and killing Baron Harkonnen.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it plays in the novel.
Yeah. Yeah. My brother is coming with many Fremen warriors.
Yes. That is some creepy-ass shit and well done in the movie. Jeff, what were you going to say?
That's how it plays in the novel. She kills the Baron in the novel. So it's a big change from the Villeneuve.
But in the novel, she calls him grandfather, which is what he is. Yeah.
Why did he spit on Paul's mother? He's like, let me give you a little spit before
the water of the body. Maybe I can't remember.
He's just supposed to be a really sadistic, megalomaniacal guy. I mean, like it's interesting because it's like I talk about this a lot to people, but it's like it really is important to realize is like, you know, Lynch was working under the confines of a PG rating. Like the movie ultimately got a PG-13 because the PG-13 rating was literally invented like a couple months before the movie came out. But like he was operating under has to be PG. So he had to code a lot of stuff, especially with the Baron. But if you compare the Baron to Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, they're almost the same character. It's just that, you know, Frank Booth can say fuck. and Baron Vladimir cannot, you know, so, you know, but it's the same big, you know, kind of, you know, twisted, sadistic performance, you know, and it's like, and I personally don't think it's campy. I think it's just the other side of camp. Mm-hmm. I think it's just that's who the character is. Yeah. And I think that was kind of something that was missing from Stellan Skarsgård's performance, which I found kind of one note and bland and, you know, a little too indebted to Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. And that character doesn't need to be subdued. Like he can be big.
He can have fun.
And did you guys ever see the
costume that he's wearing too, that Kenneth MacMillan is wearing? It's made out of like colostomy bag rubber. It's like everything about it is just disgusting.
The Sci-Fi Channel Dune, the Harkonnen there is not subtle at all. Like at one point is talking directly to the camera like a Sega CD game. So, you know, makes sense for that.
That scene with him and what's his name? Eating and like smearing the meat on their faces and talk.
Or when he like eats one of his I gotta say, a lot of the stuff that happens with the underlings in the new Dune is implied.
Yeah.
Whereas in this movie, honestly, that was one of the most haunting scenes of David Lynch Dune. Is right after he like briefs Rabin and Fade Rautha, they bring in like one of their underlings and he kind of opens up that guy's like tube and starts like gnawing on him, and it's like really upset. That was really upsetting.
I was more
upsetting than a lot of the Baron Harkonnen stuff in the Dune in the Denis movies. Go ahead, Jeff.
True. I was amazed how many people in this movie Lynch was like, sorry, you're just going to have a haircut that will require months to go back to normal. I'm sorry. It has to look weird. So we're just going to take a razor and go right down the center of your
head.
Right to the edge.
Yeah. Not all the way.
Yeah. So you're either going to go bald or you're going to look like a real doofus for quite a while after shooting this one scene you're in.
Jeff, would you, as an actor, if you, you know, were acting in David Lynch Dune and he was like, you got to do the shave, would you ever do that for any role,
I would, if David Lynch asked me to do it, I would do it.
Excellent.
That is something that Paul Atreides and David Lynch have in common is they both had a huge cult of personality, you know, around themselves. Like people loved David, like, you know, even people who ultimately hated the movie, you know, or didn't have a great time working on it, they uniformly loved David and would have done anything for him. Like those are the words that everybody uses. So it's like he was a very easygoing, like, groovy guy, you know, said, swell, Nido Kino, like, you know, it's like, was not like a screamer, was not like a, you know, an asshole the way like Michael Cimino was on Heaven's Gate. Like he was a very loved person, you know, and yeah, and like I think that's how he got a lot of those people to really go out on a limb, you know, because a lot of people would look at the requirements of this movie, you know, just like physically, like being out there in the desert, you know, or being at Churubusco Studios for 6 months shooting this motherfucker, like, you know, like it took a toll, but like, everybody rallied and everybody mm-hmm. really, you know, gave their all to the movie.
Jeff, you rose a good point, by the way. People love Villeneuve too. So it's like, yeah, the only way to do a Dune movie is to be good to people. Yeah. So
I guess
it's a hard movie to make. Yes. You know, it's really, you're asking a lot.
Let's normalize that behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think I love the fact that Villeneuve has decided to just update the entire Sean Young oeuvre. Yes. I can't wait to see his No Way Out. I'm excited when that comes out.
Wow. Yeah.
Or his Ace Ventura Pet Detective.
Ace Ventura Pet Detective. That's the one that we really got to wait for.
There you go.
I got to say, shout out to Stellan Skarsgård. Apparently he was in the makeup chair for 6 hours a day to put on the Harkonnen suit, 2 hours a day to take it off. And you might be asking yourself, how did he go to the bathroom during the time? He didn't. He didn't drink water and pounded Imodium AD so he wouldn't have to poop.
That doesn't sound healthy at all.
Yeah.
No, destroying your intestines.
This is the sacrifice he made for his art.
Well, so. Kenny McMillan wasn't that far from that either. Like his suit, you know, I think his suit and him altogether weighed over 400 pounds. And he couldn't walk and he had to be like, you know, the harness that he's in for the film was also like literally to like move him around. Like he couldn't move him. Oh, man. And then he had to have
floating around is fun to watch, you know.
Yeah, he had to have those pustules and everything and the black fingernails. And sometimes he would just go to dinner like at a restaurant dressed like that.
All right. I want to ask Max one or two questions about the fact that he is on the Wikipedia page for this movie and what that's about. But before we do that, any other closing thoughts on David Lynch's 1984?
Patrick Stewart, what a fox. Come on.
Dude. I guess he's just always looked like that.
Always looks like that.
He's like not too far off from starting Next Generation, but that is his look. And he's one of my favorite parts of the movie. He's pretty wonderful. Just his commanding presence and, yeah,
we can't not mention David Bowie.
Yes,
who is a specimen. Doesn't have much to do in this.
Do you mean Sting?
I think you mean Sting. Sting.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Come on,
yes,
Jeff.
Pardon me. Oh my
How
goodness.
Dare you?
I mean,
Labyrinth
not
is a different episode.
Not the worst mistake to make because it's very plausible David Bowie would be in this movie.
No, I apologize.
Yes.
I did.
Yes.
I don't know why my brain did that.
Yeah.
He looks a little bit like Bowie in Legend.
He does.
They were the young Harkonnens.
Sting, yes. Who looks like a specimen in this movie. And I recall, you know, there being this big thing like, oh, it's one of the worst performances ever. Da, da, da. And now revisiting it, I'm like, he's not bad. He doesn't even have anything to do. He's just hanging around, you know? He's not bad in it.
You want to go nuts? Let's go nuts. That's what he did.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's unfortunate because it's like, I think it had to do with the timing too. Cause like the character was always, you know, pretty small, you know, especially if you can't include like the gladiator battle and all that stuff. Like, you know, it was always intended to be a supporting role. It's just that while he was shooting in Mexico, you know, Synchronicity came out and he became the biggest star in the world, literally. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, so that when the time came to do the marketing, you know, Sting's face is all over it, you know, and I can see a lot of people coming in and being like, wait, he's only in 5 minutes of this thing.
All right. I want to talk about this Wikipedia stuff. Before we do that, though, why don't we let people know where they can find more of Max's work? Obviously, you should check out his book, A Masterpiece in Disarray, and also check out his screening of the David Lynch Dune at the Texas Theater on March 9th in Dallas, Texas. Max, anything else you want to mention before we dive into the final part of this conversation?
Yeah. So besides the thing on March 9th, on March 15th, I'm going to be in Richmond, Virginia at GalaxyCon. I'm going to be there with the Inglorious Trexperts guys. We're doing a panel, and I'll be signing books at their booth. And then on the 28th of March, I'll be at Dark Delicacies in Burbank, the great occult bookstore. That signing is at 6 p.m. on March 28th. And then on the 29th, I'll be again reuniting with the Trexperts dudes at WonderCon in Anaheim. Awesome. I think our panel is at 5.
Buddy, I do want to tell you, Max, it is so good to hear all this because I've been talking to Max for years as he was working and researching on this book. And like to see it all happen, it's mm-hmm. amazing. It's out there. It's great.
Yeah. Finally. Yeah. No, yeah, it was 2 years of, you know, and it was like it was a tightrope walk too, because I didn't get David Lynch until mm-hmm. over a year into the writing process. So to not know if you have a viable book mm-hmm. for a year yeah. and a half was, yeah. you know, that was a lot to hang on to. But once I got David, it became a lot easier to get, you know, like Kyle McLachlan, Sean Young, you know, Rafaela De Laurentiis, like, you know, all the great people who spoke right. to me for the book. So, yeah. And I should say, too, it's like the book is 560 pages, but it's not academic at all. It's meant to be really, really fun. And it's also kind of chunked. So like there's all these different sections and subsections. So like if you're not into the music, skip that section. If you're not into the costumes, mm-hmm. skip that section, you know.
Love a good organized book. All right. So this following section may contain spoilers for future Dune books. So
yes.
Do not listen if you do not want to be spoiled on future Dune stuff that you have not seen yet.
Yes.
Max Avery is on the official Wikipedia, or not the official, the Wikipedia page for David Lynch's Dune. Here is what it says on Wikipedia. In July 2023, writer Max Avery, doing research for his book A Masterpiece in Disarray, on the first film's influence, discovered Lynch's half-completed draft treatment for the second film at the Frank Herbert Archives at California State University. Lynch was reached for comment in January 2024 and responded through a representative that he recalled beginning work on a script, but much like the first film, he did not want to comment further. Based partly on Dune Messiah, Avery described the tentatively titled Dune 2 as having surpassed the novel's narrative approach in the screenplay adaptation. Mm-hmm. So that is, congrats on making it onto the Wikipedia page, Max. I guess just any thoughts you have about the half-completed draft that David Lynch wrote for Dune sequel that never happened.
Yeah, so, you know, this was a thing that I'd, you know, known about for years, you know, that like that he had wanted and intended to do a sequel after the first one, and that the plan was to actually do three of them and to do to do Dune Messiah and Children of Dune back to back in 1986. And they had, you know, pieces of sets and models and costumes and all sorts of stuff stored away for use. And, you know, that didn't happen for obvious reasons. And it's a shame because you could feel that Dune Messiah would have been much more in Lynch's wheelhouse. Because the book itself is a much more internal book. It's not so much about, you know, big epic battles. It's about sort of palace intrigue and psychological one-upsmanship, of course, people who can distort their faces and, you know, and sort of identity stuff that comes up again and again in Lynch's oeuvre as he goes on, you know, with like Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive and, you know, all those types of things. So it was more in his wheelhouse, and he really took command of the first, you know, whatever it would have been, like 10 or 15 minutes of what could have been Dune 2, where he totally goes off book and he takes you back to the Harkonnen attack on the Atreides fortress on Arrakeen, and then you find out that Cytale, the face dancer from Dune Messiah, was actually, you know, masquerading as the doctor that Leonardo Cimino plays in Dune Part 1. So I think that's such a cool thing that he was laying those Easter eggs, you know, so carefully. And it's something that Lynch doesn't get enough credit for because, you know, I think people think of him as the neo-noir guy, but he's also an amazing world builder, you know, and I think he was a good choice for Dune. And the Dune Messiah script proves it by this, you know, like, you know, having all these things pay off from the first film, you know, like they talk a little bit about the making it rain thing, but no, but like the first 10 or so pages is just Cytale kind of Frankensteining Duncan Idaho back to life. And it's some of the strangest imagery that you've ever read in your entire life. I have some excerpts from it in the Wired article, but you know, you have like very hallucinogenic, you know, scenes of like these Tlilaxu characters who are like these men with giant breasts and they're sort of like hermaphrodites and, you know, they're really sadistic and weird and they speak in this kind of, you know, strange, like, you know, almost Aztecian language. And yeah, it's just bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like kind of gibberish what you're saying, you know, but
also tell me more.
Yeah. But yeah. Also tell me more. And also it's really cool that you uncovered it. So, you know, mm-hmm. congrats on being a part of the history of the David Lynch Dune.
Thank you. Yeah, I know. Yeah. It does sound a little word salad-y. I mean, like when I was reading the script for the first time, the Dune 2 script, I thought it was high. It's so strange, especially at the beginning. But then as it goes on, it stays fairly close to the beats of Frank's book. But it does what Jeff was talking about. Like it externalizes the internal and you know, is more cinematic. You know, like that's a thing David was really good at. You know, he's good at taking, you know, kind of unadaptable material and making it really cinematic. Like even, you know, I mean, would you guys say that's fair that like the Lynch Dune, whether you think it's a good movie or a bad movie, wouldn't you say it's pretty goddamn cinematic?
I think that's why I appreciate some parts of it. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I would say most of it is. There's some parts that are people standing around in rooms extremely brightly lit, you know, very stage awkwardly, blocked. But yeah, I think most of it, there definitely is a keen cinematic eye at work in a lot of it. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah,
go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, like, you know, for those of you who, you know, want to read the article about the Dune Messiah script, please go ahead. But I think, like, it's really important for anybody who's really into Dune right now, who's maybe read the first book, to know, like, you know, you don't really get what Frank was going for unless you've read Dune Messiah. Like, Messiah as a, you know, as a story, it's really more of an epilogue to Dune. Like, I don't know why the two of them aren't just published together because it's like you really have to know what becomes of Paul to really understand that, like, he's not a hero.
Right.
He's like a reluctant monster. And, you know, and that's, of course, the direction that, you know, Villeneuve is going in. Like, he told me himself when I interviewed him recently, like, you know, yeah, like he sees Dune as a tragedy, which it is.
And it's like it's like Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead. Mm-hmm. It's like you know, that's the sequel completely recontextualizes the original.
So that's if I have any final thoughts, it's just don't wait whatever it's going to be like 5 or 6 years, you know, for Denis Villeneuve's Dune Messiah. Like, you know, read the book, you know, like really like get a sense of, you know, what this whole thing's about, you know, especially with this election coming up.
Indeed. Max Avery, thank you so much for joining us today on the Filmcast After Dark. Really appreciate it.
Thank you guys for having me.